Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Thursday the 18th of June. Today we reveal that Tony Blair was aware of the existence of a secret interrogation policy that effectively led to British citizens and others being tortured.
We've asked Tony Blair what role, if any, he played in the development of the policy, what he knew about its consequences, i.e. the people were being tortured as a result of the application of this policy, and what attempts he made to change it. And he has chosen not to answer those questions.
In Iran, a sixth day of protests as the regime rounds up opposition leaders.
The government threw everything that they had against these demonstrations, and 500,000 still turned out.
And Parliament publishes details of MPs' expenses claims today. But is it too little too late?
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Bill Overton with the headlines and today's papers.
Another government minister's resigned after revelations about her financial affairs in the Daily Telegraph. Kitty Usher, who's only been a Treasury minister since the reshuffle last week, was shown to have avoided capital gains tax when selling a house in her constituency. On the advice of her accountant, for just a month, she claimed it was her main home and so saved £17,000 in tax. In her resignation letter, she claims she's done nothing wrong, but the Prime Minister Gordon Brown said it was impossible for a Treasury Minister to be seen to be avoiding tax. The House of Commons publishes its official details of MPs' expenses today, but much of the information that's been leaked to The Telegraph will be blacked out in the files being published online. MPs have been allowed to go through their expenses censoring information, such as home addresses and bank details. The Governor of the Bank of England says he needs more power to control the financial stability of city institutions. He was speaking at the annual Mansion House dinner just after the Chancellor said there didn't need to be changes in how the city was regulated. But the Governor, Mervyn King, said he was only able to give advice to businesses in danger of collapse. It was the Financial Services Authority that had the power to make them change. The Governor also said some of the banks, which nearly collapsed last year, were too big to fail and so should be broken up. In Iran, the presidential challenger Mir Hossein Mousavi has called on his supporters to take to the streets of the capital again today. Even though hundreds have been arrested by government security forces this week, hundreds of thousands are expected to protest. They've been asked to wear black and to attend mosques to mourn for eight people killed in a rally on Monday. The call for further demonstrations is an open defiance of the country's supreme leader and authorities who've banned such rallies. That's the story on several front pages again this morning. The Telegraph headline reads, "Arrests in Iran fail to silence protesters." The Times calls it the silent rebellion, saying that Iran's green protest turns black in mourning. And The Guardian's version is Green Tide, defying crackdown, Mousavi supporters march again. They all have pictures of various protesters, among them one of the Iranian footballers who put on green armbands for a match. But the main story for The Telegraph is, of course, the resignation of Treasury Minister Kitty Usher. The Guardian has its own exclusive, a letter revealing that former PM Tony Blair knew of a secret policy on torture. The letter, as we'll hear in detail shortly, contained guidance to MI5 and MI6 officers involved in interrogating suspected terrorists. Two other breaking stories in the papers. The Express says there have been three more arrests in the case of the Plymouth nursery worker accused of child pornography and sexual assault. Police in Nottingham arrested a woman and two men as part of the investigation. And The Sun has a report about an illegal immigrant from Afghanistan who smuggled himself into Sandhurst by hiding next to the toilet on a coach travelling back from Germany. The headline reads, "Lou Goes There." More news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
The Guardian reveals today that when he was Prime Minister, Tony Blair knew about a secret interrogation policy used during counter-terrorism investigations. The instructions led to prisoners being tortured, including British citizens. The existence of such a policy came to light in the High Court when an MI5 officer was giving evidence in the case of Binyam Mohammed, the British resident then being held at Guantanamo Bay. The Guardian's Ian Cobain has the story.
It's a policy that is about what doesn't happen as much as what does happen, and it determines what British intelligence officers don't have to do, and it has resulted effectively in British citizens and others being tortured. We know that after 9/11, a policy was drawn up in response to an alert from an MI6 officer that he was interrogating somebody in Afghanistan who had been mistreated in some way by the American military shortly before the questioning began. And this officer was told that he or she did not have to intervene to prevent this mistreatment happening, but could not be seen to condone it and must not participate in the mistreatment himself or herself. And that advice was then given to every single MI5 and MI6 officer in Afghanistan and has formed the basis of a policy that's been further developed with some key changes in 2004, but which has overseen British intelligence interrogations of terrorism suspects all over the Middle East and South Asia, and has underpinned British intelligence's relationships with some of the most unsavoury overseas intelligence agencies.
Well, The Guardian reveals today that what's long been suspected is that Number 10 Downing Street knew about this policy.
It's clear that Number 10 Downing Street knew of the policy in 2004. Whether they knew about it when it was first developed in 2002, we don't know. We've asked Tony Blair several times what role, if any, he played in the development of the policy, what he knew about its consequences, i.e. the people were being tortured as a result of the application of this policy, and what attempts he made to change it. And he has chosen not to answer those questions. But we can see from published government reports that Tony Blair had an awareness of the policy in the middle of 2004. I understand that it was developed slightly since that period, and we now know, because of a statement made by Gordon Brown last March, that the whole policy is going to be completely rewritten and is then going to be made public.
But David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, said that the existing policy, in other words, the policy as it exists before it's being rewritten, won't be made public.
No, he was asked a couple of days ago by a group of MPs at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, will you make this public? And he said no, because there's a number of court cases ongoing. In actual fact, the only ongoing court cases are those in which the government is being sued by the alleged victims of this policy. He was then asked, well, will you publish it once these court cases are no longer ongoing? And he said, no, we're not going to do it then either, because to do so would give succour to our enemies. Which enemies he means, I don't know.
And the Foreign Secretary told MPs that Britain would never procure intelligence or procure evidence through torture. This is a claim that the government's made repeatedly, but which now looks pretty threadbare.
It looks completely threadbare. What the Foreign Secretary said was, we would never procure intelligence or procure evidence through torture. We would never say to another intelligence agency, please get us information about X and, you know, abandon our legal and ethical commitments in respect of how you find that. The problem is that that is exactly what has happened in a number of cases. In the case of a man called Rangzib Ahmed, for example, who was detained in Pakistan by a notorious Pakistani intelligence agency in August 2006 and held completely unlawfully, we know that MI5 and British police officers drew up a list of questions, which they gave to this intelligence agency and said, can you put them to this man? And by the time this man was deported to Britain, 13 months later, three of his fingernails were missing, and three of his fingernails had been ripped out, and he had been subjected to all sorts of other torture and inhumane treatment. So this is what Mr Miliband says, but actual fact that the evidence, as heard in court, contradicts what he says.
Ian Cobain, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk. Also on The Guardian's website, John Henley goes on a booze cruise to investigate whether there are still alcoholic bargains to be had, or whether the strength of the euro has put a stop to all that. Find out at guardian.co.uk/travel. Lucy Mangan looks at 10 ways to kill a fly. That's after Barack Obama's virtuoso performance. guardian.co.uk/G2. And we preview the Edinburgh Festival. Lynn Gardner says there's nervousness after last year's ticketing fiasco. guardian.co.uk/arts. In Iran, in the face of a bloody government crackdown, opposition supporters are gathering in cities across the country today in a sixth day of protest against last week's disputed election. The main opposition presidential candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, has called on supporters to mourn protesters who've lost their lives. Yesterday, more than 500,000 were thought to have joined a demonstration in Tehran. I asked our diplomatic editor, Julian Borgia, where the protests were heading.
It's very hard to say, but it's clear that they have stamina, that this is a phenomenal turnout yesterday in view of widespread arrests and a crackdown on media, all forms of media. this is a really, you know, the government threw everything that they had against these demonstrations, and 500,000 still turned out. It's shown to have a lot of resilience and a lot of flexibility in terms of getting the word out, where to gather, where to head for, using mobile phones, Twitter, all these sort of new media methods as a way of getting around the normal forms of censorship. So it's shown that, you know, the government's having a hard time getting these protests under control.
We'll hear from Simon Tisdall shortly about the response of the American government, but it was interesting that Barack Obama's administration intervened to keep Twitter on the road, allowing Iranian demonstrators to keep communicating with each other and with the outside world.
Yeah, it showed an awareness that Twitter has become one of the main forms of communication, almost the lifeblood of this wave of demonstrations, and also a way for the demonstrators to get their message out and get news out to the outside world after foreign media has been pretty much closed down in the streets of Tehran.
Is it easy, though, for demonstrators to find out what's happening? I mean, clearly they are gathering together, but, you know, who's leading the demonstrators?
Well, that's the interesting thing about it. It doesn't seem to be a top-down lead from Mousavi and Mousavi's camp. It seems to be organic. It doesn't seem to be one particular leader. It's word of mouth. It's networking. And that's why it's proved so hard for the government to get a handle on it.
They have rounded up hundreds of opposition supporters, including some of the most vociferous critics.
That's right. Some of the best-known commentators, journalists. One example, Saeed Lelah's an economist and commentator. See his quotes are seen in all the Western media in the run-up to the elections. And that's a big name that they've pulled in. These are really the intellectual driving force behind this movement. What they're trying to do is decapitate that. But from what we've seen yesterday and what we're likely to see today, it's a far more widespread movement than that.
Another interesting development yesterday was an international football match in South Korea involving the Iranian football team, and they wore green armbands in the first half in an apparent show of solidarity with the protesters.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary symbolic move. The Iranian football team is iconic in a football-mad country, and no doubt everyone across the country would have been watching that game. And for them to come out with green wristbands was a really striking show of support.
And another possible moment of tension, especially for the regime, is tomorrow, Friday prayers. What might happen then?
Well, the student organisation has been talking about organising a sit-in. Friday prayers are always a focus of political activity because it's where people get together to hear sermons from some of the leading clerics. It'll be also interesting to see what some of these clerics in the religious city of Qom, for example, what position they take, because there are a lot of clerics out there. It's not a monolithic regime. There's a wide range of views among the clerics. It'll be interesting to see what they have to say on Friday tomorrow.
And what about divisions within the regime? How serious are they?
Well, they're very serious for the regime. It's about as divided as it's ever been. The main figure in this, a pivotal figure in this, is Hashemi Rafsanjani, former president, is playing a key role. He's a supporter of Mousavi, but he's very much a regime insider. And as far as we know, he's been trying to get support from centrist clerics in Qom and elsewhere to put pressure on the supreme leader Khamenei. He's also reported that he's suggested the convening of the Assembly of Experts, which is a one body in the whole system that has the clout to scrutinize and, if necessary, dismiss the supreme leader.
Julian Borger. Well, as we've heard, America's intervention in events in Iran has so far been limited to asking Twitter to keep going. But there's mounting pressure on President Barack Obama to go further. Our foreign affairs specialist, Simon Tisdall, believes Obama's in a difficult position.
Well, at the present time, John, Obama's a bit of an onlooker in the Middle East, just like everybody else. No one quite knows how this is going to turn out. It potentially has quite serious implications for his policy of unclenching the fist towards Iran, because if Ahmadinejad retains power and comes back in an angry and bitter mood, and the leadership remains divided, it's going to be harder to do credible, lasting business with that regime. If Mousavi comes in, that's the opposition leader, then he'll have to form a government, form a policy, and it's not entirely clear what line he'll take, although it won't be that very different from what's been taken up to now. It's also a problem, a dilemma for Obama, because to what degree does he speak out in support of the people on the streets of Tehran, in other words, pro-democracy promotion, which is the sort of thing that got a bad name during the Bush administration, or does he just pursue the US national interest, largely keep quiet, and just concentrate on getting the deals that he wants?
Could you perhaps paint a slightly more positive light on what's happening, though, in the sense that whoever emerges in power after the dust has settled in Iran, there does seem to be an appetite for a different relationship with the West in Iran?
I think that's entirely true, but I also think it's been entirely true for a number of years. I think the Iranian nation, which is a very youthful nation, most of the population is well under the age of 30, is effectively held hostage by the regime that came into power in 1979. It has at various times had various degrees of legitimacy, but election fiddling is by no means a new thing in Iran. There has long been pressure from but very well-educated, middle-class, often female, urban areas for change in Iran. What's happened in the last week or so is it's come to the surface. Normally it's kept well in check by the apparatus of the regime. I've got a feeling, although I'd like to be positive, that the regime will establish its control in the next few days, is already doing so, in fact, and that this great passion for change will be pushed under the surface again.
And the regime's been trying to paint the opposition as being a puppet of Iran's foreign enemies.
That's a well-tried, tested tactic of the regime. Whenever there's any kind of unrest in Iran, the various authorities, usually the Interior Ministry or the Intelligence Ministries or the Revolutionary Guard spokesman, blame foreign agents. Sometimes they name them, sometimes they say it's the US, sometimes they say it's Mossad, the Israeli spy agency, sometimes they blame British intelligence. They never, as far as I know, produce any evidence for this. But this is an attempt to cover over some of the strains within Iranian society, were not just to do with who's president, but to do with minority rights, because, as you know, Iran has many numerous minorities, not all of whom are entirely enamoured with the way things are run in Tehran.
And is there a danger that the instability in Iran could affect Iran's neighbours?
Absolutely. It's not quite as serious as the effect that Iraq has had on the neighbourhood in the last 6 years, but Iran has a lot of influence and a lot of say in what goes on in Iraq, for instance, these days, which has a Shia-led government closely allied to Tehran. If there's a collapse in power in Tehran or some kind of ongoing instability, that could destabilise potentially Iraq. It could also have an effect, looking the other way, on Afghanistan, which is a great Western priority at the moment.
Simon Tisdall. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in today's show, shame in Belfast after racist thugs drive Romanian families from their homes.
I don't want these people to leave Belfast because of a small minority of people who seem to be without any respect for human life or human dignity.
But first, details of MPs' expenses are published today, not by the Daily Telegraph, but by Parliament itself. Well, the devil is in the detail, of course, but Parliament's version of allowances data will be edited. In The Guardian's Westminster office, our chief political correspondent Nicholas Watt says there'll be particular attention today on what would have been hidden if the Daily Telegraph had not obtained the information several weeks ago.
Well, it's going to be a pretty big day. We've had to rely on the Daily Telegraph for the last month to find out what's going on with MPs' expenses, because they managed to procure a copy of that computer disc with all the MPs' expenses. We don't know exactly how they procured it, but they did get it, and wow, did they unsettle the political establishment. So today, the Commons authorities are releasing those expenses details. But what's going to be really interesting is that the Daily Telegraph had the disc with all the details, the stuff that we're going to be getting today. Well, this is of course going to be redacted, because MPs were nervous about their bank account details being there. They were nervous about details of their staff being there, and they were nervous about their addresses being there, which on the face of it, that seems perfectly reasonable. But one of the big things that the Daily Telegraph have done is, because they've had everyone's addresses, because they had the unedited details of those computer disks, they were able to expose what we're now calling flipping, which is MPs changing the designation of their homes to max up the expenses details. If you don't have the addresses of the MP's home, you cannot find out the flipping. So it will be interesting to see whether that redaction really has gone ahead.
And is there going to be much detail that MPs are worried about us finding out about?
I think MPs have been nervous for the last month as they've seen lots of their details being exposed to the public. All those MPs who are standing down. We got one by-election after Ian Gibson, Labour MP, stood down in anger after he was had the Labour whip withdrawn from him. So, yes, there will be nervousness that more stuff will be out there. But, hey, the Daily Telegraph have had this stuff for a month. They've put a whole team of people on it. And I know we're not meant to say this because we're a rival publication, but haven't they done well and exposed a great deal of interesting details.
And meanwhile, Nick, the Commons Speaker, Michael Martin, presided over his last Prime Minister's questions yesterday, and he had a bit of a dig at the party leaders for not acting to change the system when they had the chance a year ago.
And I wish that party leaders would have shown then some of the leadership which they have shown now. Tradition has it that such votes are not whipped, but this does not remove the responsibility of leaders to speak up for common sense and for the obvious wishes of the country in seeking reform. We should have done this last year.
Well, it was interesting. It was Michael Martin's last Prime Minister's questions as Speaker, and then after that, it was officially tributes to the Speaker. Now, you'd normally assume that that would be a sort of a solemn, maybe even a light-hearted occasion where everyone says, didn't you do a marvellous job, pat him on the back and off he goes. Well, it didn't quite have that flavour to really for two broad reasons. The first was that clearly Michael Martin is very, very hurt at the way that he feels he was brought down. And he began by speaking for well over half an hour. And he was speaking in quite emotional terms about his 30 years as an MP, coming as somebody who started out as a sheet metal worker and rising to become Speaker of the House of Commons. That was pretty emotional. And really, the second different element was it was quite a parting shot for both the party leaders, the main party leaders, and essentially saying the way that it seems to be out there is that this great expenses scandal has come out. I, the Speaker, have been the barrier to reform, and that's why you're getting rid of me. And essentially what he was saying was that I was onto the case for the need for reforms a year ago.
Nicholas Watt. In Belfast, more than 100 Romanian nationals are planning to leave the country after they were driven from their homes by racist thugs. 20 families were evacuated by the police on Tuesday night to shelter in Belfast City Church. For several nights, a crowd of about 20 people gathered outside their properties and attacked them, shouting Nazi slogans. Henry MacDonald, our Ireland correspondent, says the attacks were orchestrated.
Yes, they were orchestrated because they've been going on for several nights since indeed the end of last week. Indeed, Anna Lowe, who's a South Belfast Assembly member, a representative of the area, claims that in one of the incidents there was a gun, it could have been a replica gun, we don't know, was produced. So the intensity of the attacks, the number of them, there were a number of family homes attacked, suggest it was organised in some way, locally at least. I was speaking to local residents in the village, Donegal Road and Lisburn Road areas. This is the epicentre of where the trouble is. And they were saying to me that this problem has been ongoing since about November, that it was initially Polish and Slovakian families that were attacked, and now it's the Roma people who are being targeted. So they're saying there is a gang in that area who are racially motivated, who are determined to cause trouble to people who are not from Northern Ireland.
And what are local people who aren't part of this gang think about what's been going on?
Well, I think the majority would be appalled at the kind of level of violence, about children being attacked and you know, windows being smashed and kids being put in the firing line. But there is a feeling in some loyalist working class areas like the village that they're being edged out of their communities, that they're becoming far too more multi-ethnic, that kind of thing. And there's particular hostility to the Roma community, more say than there would be towards Polish people, because the Roma can't, apart from younger people, can't work, so that they may earn a living, for example, selling the big issue. And there's a lot of allegations in the local press, whether they're substantial or not is another matter, about people being begging outside banks and shops and things like that there. So there is a residue of resentment in the loyalist working class. It doesn't happen in Republican areas, it only happens in loyalist areas, it has to be said.
And what efforts are community leaders going to make now to cool down these racial tensions?
Well, there was unity. There were loyalist politicians. There was Martin McGuinness of Sinn Féin. There was Geoffrey Donaldson. There was a representative of the party that used to represent the UDA, all of them condemning this. So I would assume that there'll be a big effort politically to end this problem, because apart from anything else, it's a major embarrassment to the city of Belfast. I was speaking to the Lord Mayor, just elected, Naomi Long, and she said it cast a stain of shame over the city.
Henry MacDonald. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.